Hi, I'm Rod Kurtz, and you're listening to week number two of Best of Alberta, Blueprint H2O. This is the second week of our three-week series looking at Alberta's water supply. How much do we have? Are we running out? This week, reporter Mark Harvey looks into Edmonton's water supply. How does the city continue to provide safe drinking water for a growing population? All of Edmonton's water comes from the Saskatchewan Glacier, and it's melting. We'll hear from a world expert on how cities can adapt to climate change. Reporter Aaron Collins looks into the golf industry and how our recreation is affecting water supplies. And Gareth Hampshire will take us to northern Alberta, and we'll hear about folks' jitters in Peace River over the massive amounts of water being used by the oil and gas industry. That and more coming up on Best of Alberta, Blueprint H2O. Edmonton's tap water is the toast of the country. A report this month singled out Edmonton for its water quality, especially compared to other major cities like Vancouver and Montreal. But keeping the city's tap water safe is a growing challenge. As part of our series, Blueprint Alberta H2O, Mark Harvey looked into where the tap water comes from and how the city is working to keep it safe.
Mark, give me that brief primer. What can you tell us about Edmonton's water?
All of our water, and most of the water for the capital region, comes out of the North Saskatchewan River. Now, several years ago, there were outbreaks of waterborne illness all over North America, Kelowna, BC, also in Pennsylvania, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, there were outbreaks. And here in Edmonton, there were suspicions that unclean water had made people sick here as well. So Edmonton decided to invest very heavily in water treatment.
So how do they treat the water that we drink?
Well, the first step is to remove heavy particles and the brown color that we can see when we look at the river. Sediment is settled out of the water. Then the water is filtered to remove even more particles, the more fine particles. Then the water is treated with chlorine. And as a final step, the water is exposed to strong ultraviolet light. This hits any remaining organisms that have gone through the filtration and through the chlorine treatment, and it renders them completely harmless. By the way, Edmonton was the first major Canadian city to use ultraviolet treatment. Let's take a tour of the E.L. Smith Water Treatment Plant with Les Gemmy. He is EPCOR's Director of Quality Assurance.
Well, the water coming in is not safe. It has E. coli in it. We monitor things like E. coli every day, and there's E. coli in the river every day. There's viruses in the river. There's things like Giardia, the beaver fever organism, in the river. You know, so it's not a safe river to swim in or to drink out of. Okay, this next stage follows the clarification process where we've removed most of the particles, the color, organics. What we're left with is a fairly clear-looking water, but it's got a lot of small particles in it. So we pass it through these filter beds. They're anthracite sand, about 3 feet deep. The water passes through those, you know, fairly slowly. It takes about 20 minutes. And the small particles get stuck on the grains of sand. And then the clear water will then come out the bottom. We collect that and take it into our on-site reservoir. This next section is the UV disinfection treatment system. The water's come out of the filter, so it's clear. It's been disinfected with chlorine a little, but we've added this UV system to provide quite a bit of added protection for things like beaver fever, Giardia, Cryptosporidium. This gives us about another thousandfold factor of removal for these things. The units are large UV systems with lamps in them, but it only takes about 2 seconds to pass through the unit, but the UV light at that time can inactivate the anything that's there. We do a little bit of pH adjustment at that point, and then out the water goes into the finished water reservoir.
It's a very interesting process. Fascinating, in fact. Les Gemmy there, the Director of Quality Assurance for EPCOR, giving us a tour of the E.L. Smith Water Treatment Plant.
And so what kind of challenges, then, Mark, does Edmonton face in ensuring that they have an ample supply of safe tap water?
It does face challenges. Three main ways it's challenged. First, there's the fact that the river itself is contaminated, as Les described. It may be pure at its source in the Columbia Ice Field, but on the way, the North Saskatchewan picks up runoff from farmland and effluent from small communities. Then there's the increasing demand for water from a population that's one of the fastest growing in the country. And thirdly, increasingly there's climate change. The glacier that supplies the river is shrinking. And for all three reasons, EPCOR has decided to expand the E.L. Smith treatment plant in West Edmonton. That will increase the amount of drinking water available to the city by 25%.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the shrinking glacier. That's the example of climate change writ large. But what does it mean here in Edmonton?
No one knows for sure. But there are, of course, climate change models, and they point to a couple of things. Milder winters with less snowfall.
Certainly seen that.
And hotter summers. In addition, there are suggestions that intense storms may become more common in future. And what this all means is that the level in the North Saskatchewan River may rise and fall more dramatically in future than it has in the recent past. It is already a shallow river in most places. And if there are more periods of high runoff or, conversely, longer dry spells, it'll take longer for EPCOR to purify the water it takes out of the river, more time to move through that process. And all of this presumes no extra development upstream dumping things into the river. Here again is Les Gammy.
The big thing is, of course, we don't know exactly how much of a challenge it's going to be. All the information says that there'll be less water in the future. We're not quite sure how much less. And of course, Alberta's growing, the population is increasing, so you got this double whammy of more population, less water. We only pull 3-4% of the water out of the North Saskatchewan that's there right now. So, and the North Saskatchewan isn't fully allocated, so we have quite a ways to go before it becomes a big issue. But I think in the future, you will see more conservation things coming into place, maybe more flood conditions, more drought, and certainly that's something we'd have to learn to deal with.
And finally, the Saskatchewan Glacier out of the Columbia Icefield, the source of the river that provides Edmonton with all its water. Some studies give the Saskatchewan Glacier less than 100 years before it melts away completely. Now that, of course, outside our lifetime, but not the lifetimes of our grandchildren or great-grandchildren.
And it is instructive to drive up along the David Thompson Highway and see the early stages of the North Saskatchewan River and see the beautiful blue color of that river there as opposed to what we see here.
Yeah, indeed.
Mark, thanks for doing this.
You're welcome.
This is CBC's Mark Harvey.
That's reporter Mark Harvey in conversation with Edmonton AM host Ron Wilson. Just moments ago, Mark referred to the Saskatchewan Glacier. It supplies Edmonton with drinking water, and experts predict it will be completely melted away by the end of this century. Around the world, hundreds of millions of people are faced with even shorter timetables. Some of those cities are finding ways to better use the water they have and are preparing for a future with less. Peter Droege specializes in sustainable cities. He's also director of the Center for Sustainable Urbanism at Beijing University, and he's the chair of the World Council for Renewable Energy. Once again, here's Ron Wilson.
I mentioned that the melting Saskatchewan Glacier, which is Edmonton's supply of drinking water. What other cities in other parts of the world face a similar kind of circumstance?
Thousands of cities across the Andes and Himalayas. There are hundreds of millions of people at risk at the moment.
And it's exactly the same problem.
Exactly the same problem. Yes.
Ice fields are melting.
Ice fields are melting, but you need to remember that glacier water is just a small part of river water. It's mostly snow melt, groundwater, and rain precipitation coming off of the clouds.
And
so the glacier water is important, but it's really just a last resort in late summer. It's snow melt primarily that makes up maybe 80% of Canadian mountain-derived river streams.
And during particularly the drought years when we had less snow, that is...
becomes critical, yes.
Compounds the issue. How are those cities that you mentioned in the Andes and South America and in the Himalayas and in the subcontinent, how are cities that are affected by that, what are they doing?
They will migrate. There's not much they can do. There's going to be a lot of population movements. You have to remember that there's been a overpopulation in those regions. And there's been reliance on an abundant source for a long time. So these cities are stretched to the limit already. So any kind of reduction in their water household will create breaks in those conditions.
Are there lessons to be learned by what other people are doing in other parts of the world just to reduce the amount of water we all use?
There certainly are. And before I answer that question, I think it's important to remember that there are two other parts of that equation. One is the protection of the source. In other words, the rivers and the snowfields themselves are depleted for a reason. We need to change our energy system dramatically. I mean, the carbon emissions that cause these kinds of conditions.
Because of the climate change affected by what we are all putting into the air.
Climate change is just bringing to a head a problem that's been going on for a long time. And it's just putting the sort of last nail into the coffin. We need to stop the use of high carbon fuel sources and move more heavily into renewables. The other part of the equation is that about 97% of the fresh water available on a continent, 97% is groundwater, is actually below water. What you see on the surface is just a small part of water available. We need to protect the groundwater sources and not put any pollutants into these groundwater sources. So, I mean, experiences in the United States and I think in parts of Canada, but also in Australia, have shown that the pollutants we put in the ground, particularly petroleum products, will tend to make the groundwater unusable. They're not dissolvable in water.
And this is what, effluent from our cars?
No, this is tailings from, for instance, tar sand production or, you know, any kind of heavy, non-soluble pollutant that can be there for a long time.
So it gets into the groundwater and it's there.
And it's very hard to predict where it will go. It will create plumes over time that maybe take 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, but it will migrate. And you can now see how important that groundwater is because it's not just a store of some up to 30,000 years of water that's been there, but it's also a receptacle for new precipitation. There will be rain in climate change. There will be dramatic rainfalls, but they'll be unpredictable and they'll be heavy and they'll be hard to catch. Now, the groundwater is a way of storing those.
But so if we're not doing a good job of being a good steward of the groundwater, then what good will the...
Well, then we're sort of really messed up our own situation in a climate change environment. So it's to kind of combat our vulnerability to climate change, it's important to put a moratorium on any further groundwater potential pollution problems. It's just a survival issue. And the third aspect is then how to deal with that conservation issue at the end. But that in itself won't get us anywhere if we don't deal with the other two aspects.
Yeah, one is connected, as you say, with the others. Can you just give me some sense, though, of where in other parts of the world that you're familiar with, what they're doing on that conservation side and a better use of the water that we have now?
Well, it's interesting to mention that in Australia, I'm working in Sydney at the moment. In the last 10 years, the whole idea of how to manage water in the city has changed dramatically from initially just managing floods in the city, building detention basins throughout the city and making sure that sudden storm falls don't flood the streets or the sewage systems. Well, this has now emerged into a potential source for supplementing household water. Now we can use that water for grey water, for toilet flushing, for water, for washing cars, for irrigation and so forth. We can now use that water to supplement household water.
So would you have two separate sources of water coming into your home then, one for drinking and cooking and another for using?
All the new buildings have dual systems. They have black water and grey water systems. All the new buildings in New South Wales are required to have rainwater tanks. All the new buildings are required to have a 60% improved efficiency in water and energy use over 1995.
And that's not an option. You must do that.
You must do that or your building will not be approved for construction.
So all that storm water that we normally would just in parts of Edmonton, it just flows back into the North Saskatchewan River and that's the end of it. Now what you're suggesting in Sydney, they've been much more aggressive in finding a way of capturing that water and actually using it.
That is exactly the case. I mean, it's still a small part of the overall equation, and households are not just a minor part of the overall users. Remember, up to 50% of fresh water uptake is used or wasted in the generation of electricity in coal-fired power plants.
It's always when I speak to people like you, it gives us a lot of reason to one, pause, but also to rethink. Thank you for taking the time to come in and speak with me this morning.
Thank you.
Peter Droege is the director of the Center for Sustainable Urbanism at Beijing University. He's also the chair of the World Council for Renewable Energy. He was speaking to Edmonton AM's Ron Wilson. You're listening to The Best of Alberta, Blueprint H2O. If Alberta is heading towards a water crisis in the future, there could be some big changes in store for people who depend on that resource. In southern Alberta, no one depends on water more than farmers. In fact, more than 90% of the water that's taken from the Bow River is used to irrigate crops. Compare that to the 5% that's used by the entire city of Calgary, and you can understand how big an impact farming has on the water supply. Danielle Droitsch is a water activist who calls herself the Bow River Keeper.
Irrigation farming is no longer sustainable in southern Alberta, but we need to have it. So the question is not whether you have it, but to what degree is irrigation a part of our community? You know, should we continue to grow it, and should we change the way we do it? And it could be that we actually do things to help farming communities be more sustainable. And it's not just water conservation efficiency, but it's also maybe even helping those communities better make their daily living.
That's water activist Danielle Droitsch speaking about the future of irrigated farming in southern Alberta. Aaron Collins is one of our lead reporters on the Blueprint Alberta H2O series. He spoke to CBC Calgary's Jennifer Keene about the irrigation issue.
It sounds like Danielle Droitsch would like us to put a halt to irrigation in southern Alberta. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think she'd like to see people getting out of the business of irrigated farming for sure. And there's certainly people out there that think farmers are using too much water, especially here in the south. And the fact is that they really are the biggest users of water in the province. As you mentioned, 90% of the water taken from the Bow is used for agriculture, and 70% of every drop of water used in the province every year is from agriculture. So the problem is of course, that when you consider that we're going to have less water in the future with those receding glaciers we keep hearing about and the less snowpack, plus increased population, well, what are we going to do if we hit those drought years where we might not have enough water to go around?
What do farmers say about this?
Well, you know, not surprisingly, they see things a little differently. They've been counting on the land for their livelihood for generations, and pretty much they say these cycles, we've seen them before. They come, they go. There's enough water to go around. I drove south of Lethbridge near Stirling and chatted with Byron Wild and John McKee as they harvested a crop of irrigated hemp together. Here's what they had to say about water and the importance of irrigation for farmers in the south. You're going to hear John first and then Byron.
Irrigation provides stability and allows you a return. Even during those dry years, we were able to get a crop back on the irrigated fields to allow for cash flow, things like that. So yes, irrigation is an integral part of southern Alberta particularly. A big crop was just covering the bills. There was not anywhere to put any money aside to help weather through the dry years. And we know in agriculture there are dry years. In the town that I grew up in, I was one of many farmers, and now my kids, I think there's 3 farm families that go to Stirling School now.
Well, I shouldn't say it isn't a reality. I agree that the glaciers are receding at this point, but who's to say they won't be rebuilt again, who knows, you know, 50 years down the road. The perception, I guess, yeah, they have that now because that is what's happening right now, but how long is that trend going to be? It might come back within the next 10 years. Water crisis. That's a good question. No, I don't think there is. There's ample water. It's just got to be used efficiently. And lots of water here. It's just a matter of saving it, storing it. We do have those cycles where, you know, you will have receding and then you'll have ample again.
Exactly how much water is used for irrigation in Alberta?
Well, as we heard earlier, really most of the water we use here in Alberta is used for irrigation. About 70% of the water used across the province and down here in the south, about 90% of the water taken from the Bow River is used for irrigation.
How sustainable is that?
Well, environmentalists certainly don't think it's a sustainable activity to continue to water such an arid area. It's almost a desert down there at times, especially when the belief is we're going to have less water to go around in the future and more demand, more people, more industry. So, of course, on the other hand, farmers we heard from certainly don't see it that way. Their view is there's always been dry and wet years, and on average, there is enough water to go around. If farmers are just left alone to manage the water, everything will be just fine. Here's farmer Byron Wild.
The driest year we ever did have on record was 2001, and there was definitely rationing that had to be taking place there. But even with that rationing in this area, we got the crops that we needed. There was plenty for producing the crop we needed. We were limited to 8.5, 9 inches per acre.
So farmers feel they can be trusted to manage the province's water, and in general, they've done a good job. Of course, water activists certainly disagree, but there is a third, more sort of nuanced view that some people have. Gerhard Hartmann is one of these people who sort of occupy the middle ground. He's with the Old Man River Watershed Council, which is essentially a nonprofit group concerned about the sustainability of that river, which is essential to irrigation. Here's what he has to say.
I don't think it is sustainable as it is now. It's going to change. It will have to change, and the change will come as it's determined by the economics of the situation. As water increases in value, and it will, look at your own water bill in your own town where you live. It's changed. So it will be sustainable, but it will be in a different form in the future. There will be gradual improvements or changes as determined by the economics.
Aaron, if the current system isn't sustainable, as he says, what needs to be done?
Well, I asked that exact question to David Hill. He's with Irrigation Alberta, and he acknowledged that changes do need to be made in the way water is used and managed. There will be less. But he also says that we have enough time to make those changes properly. Here's how he describes what irrigators are going to have to do if the worst-case scenario on climate change happens, and there is indeed a significant reduction in the province's water supply.
What we will have had to do in that same period of time is adapt to a new flow regime and to try and mitigate those changes in flow by improvements in storage, improvements in management, improvements in the way that water is applied to crops. And what it might have meant in some cases is perhaps moving away from field agriculture to coupling that somewhat with greenhouse production. I don't see any of this as a doom and gloom future.
But if Aaron, a water crisis is possible here in Alberta, can we rely on farmers to simply voluntarily scale back their use?
Again, some people are certainly going to say no way because the farmers are too invested in irrigation. I mean, they can pretty much double the yields that they would normally get from dry land by irrigating. But in reality, farmers really have greatly improved the way they use water since irrigation began decades and decades ago. Mark Bennett is the executive director of the Bow River Basin Council. Again, another, we heard 90% of the water from the Bow River goes to irrigation. And I spoke with him on the edge of the Glenmore Reservoir, and he explained to me that farmers have long been some of the best stewards of the land.
I think the irrigators as a sector, as an industry, have in many instances led the way in water conservation programming. They are, without a doubt, the largest water user within our basin. They also have a much higher productivity rate on that irrigated land than if the same activities were undertaken, if possible, in a dryland fashion. So, you know, in southern Alberta, irrigation is an important part of our economy. There are towns, villages, and even cities that are dependent on it.
What's the provincial government's position on irrigation?
Well, the government is in a tough spot here. It'd be pretty tough for them to tell farmers in southern Alberta that they can no longer irrigate. But at the same time, there does seem to be a recognition that something has to be done about reducing the amount of water that's being used in the province. So what the government has done is to put a moratorium on water licenses on the South Saskatchewan River Basin. And that includes, of course, the Bow and the Old Man River, where a lot of the irrigation water comes from. But at the same time, they've acknowledged the first-in-right principle. And that governs the licenses and how the water is used. And it basically says that the folks with the oldest licenses get the first crack at the water. So most of those people, of course, are farmers. It does sort of ensure that they're going to continue to get their water. Now, David Schindler is a professor at the U of A and one of the foremost water activists in the province. Here's what he has to say about the government's latest move.
The moratorium on further irrigation is really an excellent first step, but we need to go further than that. We need to take some of that water back. Irrigators aren't going to like to hear that. For the last 10 years, they've been arguing that they've improved their efficiency, which they have, to their credit, but they wanted that water that they'd saved back to irrigate more land, and really that just can't happen the way this province is trying to develop.
Aaron, what do you think the future of irrigated farming is in Alberta?
Well, you know what? There could be a bit of a cop-out, but there could be a number of different answers to that. Generally, everyone that you've heard from today is right to a certain extent. Farmers have been good stewards of the land, and they're getting better. We can only hope that this continues to improve, and there is room for this to happen. They are growing crops in Israel right now with drops of water, not cubic meters of water. So there is still room to reduce their use. But at the same time, there is still the question of whether or not those reductions are going to happen fast enough. You can imagine a day in the future when farmers simply won't be able to take as much of the province's water as they do now. Whether or not farmers can reduce their use before we need them to, before water runs out, that is the real question.
Thanks, Aaron.
No problem.
That's reporter Aaron Collins in conversation with CBC Calgary's Jennifer Keane. When it comes to water, one of the big questions is how the resource is being used by the oil and gas industry. As we know, huge amounts of money are being made in Alberta from oil and gas exploration and the revenue that comes from that. But to extract the oil from the ground, massive amounts of water are used in the process. That's making some people a bit jittery in Peace River, where the next big oil sands development is just getting going. CBC reporter Gareth Hampshire has this report from Peace River.
Diane Plowman's topping up the water trough in the stables of her country home. This peaceful rural setting looks down on the valley which carves through the Peace Country. It's so quiet today, you can hear Plowman's horse Misty chomping oats. But she's nervous that could be about to change. Not far from here is the third biggest oil deposit in Alberta, the Peace River oil sands, and production is about to ramp up in a big way.
Without any consultation, we are a gravel road. Has been chosen as one of the major transportation routes that'll probably have about 300 vehicles a day.
And it's not just the traffic and noise Plowman's worried about. She has other concerns about the strain all of this oil and gas development could have on Peace River, especially the town's water supply. Oil companies divert fresh water from the Peace River itself and pipe it into their plants to extract bitumen, which contains the oil. And with such a giant operation expected here, Plowman feels a bit daunted. She started an environmental group with several other local people.
We need to think about long-term impact of taking water out, not putting it back, the climate changes that eventually have been shown to happen in an area where the water cycle is altered unnaturally.
Known as the Mighty Peace by locals, Peace River is the biggest in Alberta. But after dry conditions in recent years, close to record low water levels were reported this year, and that caused some problems. Several times this year, the water was so low in the Peace River that the Shaftesbury Ferry was forced to stay anchored. It normally takes vehicles back and forth on the short hop across the river. Those who live in that area had to drive the long way around for a time this fall. Shell, which has been mining in Fort McMurray's oil sands for years, is also leading the drilling activity at the Peace River deposit. Right now, the company produces about 12,000 barrels of oil every day in the region. Shell takes fresh water from the Peace River for its operations. The company's annual water license with the provincial government allows it to draw about as much water as it would take to fill 1,600 Olympic-sized swimming pools. That's just for its current operation, and that license comes at a nominal fee of just $900. Mary Griffiths has studied and written about the oil industry's thirst for water. She's a senior policy analyst with the Pembina Institute. Griffiths wants to see the provincial government overhaul its water licensing policy.
At the moment, companies only pay for their license, which, compared with the volumes of water they use, it's a few hundred dollars a year. Relative to the volumes of water they use, it's practically nothing.
Today, Shell is committed to developing one of the largest oil deposits on Earth and equally committed to reclaiming the land.
Shell, which has TV ads boasting about its environmental stewardship, insists it's using a small amount of water right now. And although there's no law forcing it to, the company says it will try to recycle water once its expansion starts to take shape. An expansion which could see Shell produce 100,000 barrels of oil every day. Adrian Lam is a spokesperson for Shell.
We're going to be submitting a regulatory application to the EUB by year end for a 100,000 barrel per day expansion. And then our approach to growing production in the area would be to sort of grow production in phases. And at the end of that regulatory review process, we would make a decision on whether to proceed with sort of a first phase of growth.
Because bitumen in the Peace River's oil sands is buried so far under the ground, companies need to use masses of water to bring it to the surface. So one process using steam is being used to help it liquefy the bitumen first. Cold or primary production is also being used. That uses less water. It's a series of wells which are drilled and connected by pipelines. Lamb says Shell will use cold production first.
There's some, you know, real advantages to doing that in terms of cost, lower energy, no water involved.
Today, only a small percentage of Peace River's enormous annual flow is being taken from the watershed, less than 1%. But as investment in the Peace oil sands grows, some people are ill at ease about what's on the horizon. David Schindler is a world-renowned ecologist at the University of Alberta. He says the big lesson from Fort McMurray's tar sands is to tread carefully before granting more water licenses. Schindler says in that region, the Athabasca River is suffering.
Up to three or four plants, it's probably working okay. What I fear is that when we get 20 of those things sucking water from the river, it will be in a bad state. The projections that I've seen indicate that in dry times, in midwinter, they could be taking close to half the low winter flow of the Athabasca.
The provincial government is considering changes to all of its water policies, and some have already been made. In water-short areas, industrial users have to look for alternatives to fresh water before applying for licenses. Remember, Shell only pays $900 for the water it takes from Peace River, but those minimal charges may soon be history. It's possible companies may have to pay for the actual value of the water they use. It's one option being discussed. Bev Yee is Assistant Deputy Minister of Alberta Environment.
We're going to look at the full suite of the kinds of economic instruments that are out there, but certainly the one that's been talked about the most by stakeholders has been pricing. It's basic, people understand it, and you and I know if I have to pay more for something, I'm going to think twice about whether I really need that something or whether I need to use as much of that thing.
Back on the banks of the Peace River, Diane Plowman wants to see some real action before it's too late.
We have to be the stewards of looking after that water supply for many generations. It can't just be that we're making the fast buck today.
For CBC Radio, I'm Gareth Hampshire in Peace River.
You're listening to The Best of Alberta, Blueprint H2O. I'm Rod Kurtz. In spring and summer, Albertans love to hit the links. And with more than 300 golf courses to choose from in the province, they have ample opportunity. But it takes billions of liters of water to keep those greens green. And as Alberta faces a drier future, some people are wondering whether that much of our water should be devoted to golf courses. Aaron Collins spoke to Edmonton AM's Ron Wilson about the use of water in Alberta's golf industry.
So how much water do all those golf courses use every year?
Well, I was told that an average golf course in Alberta uses about 20 million liters of water a year. That's for an 18-hole course, that is. So you multiply that by about, you know, like you said, 300 courses across the province, and you can see that a lot of water is needed to keep those golf courses going. Billions and billions of liters a year by my calculation. Plus, climate change is actually lengthening the golf season, which should increase the amount of water needed on a course. And you add all this up, and you can see why some people are so against these courses, including David Schindler from up your way. He's a world-renowned ecologist at the University of Alberta.
I think it's terrible. I think golf courses are one of the least sustainable things we do with a whole landscape. We don't get anything to eat off them. They use a lot of water. They use a lot of pesticides and fungicides and fertilizer. fertilizers, that a good part of which usually ends up in rivers. They use a lot of fossil fuels to keep them mowed and that. I wouldn't be caught dead on a golf course, frankly. I'd view it for a water scientist as like being a priest being caught in a whorehouse.
The well-known, world-renowned ecologist David Schindler from the University of Alberta. Aaron, if golf courses are using so much water, and Alberta is obviously going to have less in the years to come, will there be a day when we simply no longer can afford to have golf courses?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, some courses are getting their water from municipal supplies, which might be a problem, and some are taking their water right from a nearby source like a stream or a well. But some are being pretty innovative about where they get their water from and how efficiently they use it or recycle it. I went to Pritis Greens Golf and Country Club south of Calgary here, and they're actually getting some of the water for irrigation from the sort of small community of homes that surround the course. So basically, if someone flushes their toilet or drains their tub in one of the high-end homes that surround the course, they're actually helping to water the greens. And I talked to James Beebe, who's in charge of the grounds out in Pritis, and he says ideas like this are becoming more common and that water conservation is the issue in the golf industry.
It's probably the largest issue that the golf business is dealing with as far as the green side of the golf business is dealing with. So, all conferences, seminars, and those type of things are starting to address water usage efficiencies, using new technologies, and doing what we can to reduce water while maintaining, good golf course conditions.
How common is that green technology, to use a phrase appropriate for this on Alberta's golf courses, Aaron?
Well, it's not the norm. I mean, it's certainly not everywhere, but these ideas of water conservation are becoming much more common. In fact, Edmonton will see the province's first organic golf course when Wild Splendor Golf Course opens this spring. It's going to be pesticide and herbicide free, which of course limits that runoff we hear about, and it's going to use native grasses to minimize the amount of water used on the course. And a lot of courses are using new ideas and technologies to limit their water use. Mark Nickel is the environmental coordinator at Pritis Green. He actually goes one step further. He says that not only are golf courses getting greener, but in fact, they're good for the environment.
It's just a natural green area that basically represents the same thing as like the rainforest, where it removes various impurities from the air, it removes the impurities from the water that's being put on it. A golf course can only hold so much of that water that we use. It's not going to keep all the water forever, and I think we do actually provide a source of cleaning a lot of the impurities out of the environment.
Well, but you have to counter that, don't you not, Aaron, with all the pesticides and fertilizers that are used on golf courses?
Well, of course, yeah, that's the thing. And of course, when you're hearing from the golf industry, they're going to spin it one way, and other people would say it another way. Golf courses are using less of these pesticides and herbicides. There's no question. They're doing things like spot spraying. So they'll find the one little spot that they need to spray on rather than sort of blanket spraying the whole course. But there's no question it's a concern, because anything we spray on the land, a golf course, your lawn, anywhere, it's eventually going to end up in the rivers that provide us with our drinking water. I talked to Natalie Odd. She's with Clean Calgary, and here's what she has to say about this.
Certainly there's also issues around the chemicals that come from golf courses and end up in our sewer system. We really have to look at what is the priority of our water use. And if it's in the home, if it's drinking and cooking and cleaning, then we have to determine that and before it becomes a crisis point.
Aaron, is there anything being done now to ensure that golf courses aren't pushing us over that tipping point to the crisis as far as use of water?
Yeah, well, the concern is certainly out there, but nothing's really formally being done. There's no doctrine or anything. But as we heard, golf courses are working, and they're working quite diligently to limit the amount of water they use and the amount of pesticides they spray. But that's really kind of a voluntary thing. I actually asked Paul Fesco, who's kind of the City of Calgary's water management guru, what would happen if we got to a point here in Calgary where there wasn't enough water to go around.
We have the ability to cut them off quicker than any other customer. So it's sort of the lowest priority water that we would deliver in the city, and we just monitor it. So if we don't have the water, then we would take the golf courses offline.
As Alberta gets drier, Aaron, what will the future look like then for the golf industry in the province?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you heard, the good news, I guess, if you're a golfer especially, is golf courses are probably going to be open a little longer. And operators do sort of get the fact that they're going to have to make some changes in how they operate by using less water, putting less chemicals on their courses. And I think what we could end up seeing is courses using more green technology, but also we could end up seeing browner courses, especially during dry years, where as we heard, municipalities can cut off courses from their water supply.
Aaron, thanks as always.
You bet.
That's Edmonton AM's Ron Wilson in conversation with CBC Calgary reporter Aaron Collins. And that wraps up this edition of Best of Alberta, Blueprint H2O, a three-week series on CBC Radio in Alberta. And it continues next week, but if you miss any of it, we'll have it for you on Best of next week. If you'd like to comment about anything you've heard, please contact us by going to cbc.ca and click on Contact Us on the left side of the screen. Have a great week. I'm Rod Kurtz.